Did you know that the University of Central Missouri has been leading innovation for nearly 150 years? With more accreditations and more qualified faculty members, our commitment to academic success is unparalleled. And we make sure every student receives the support they need to graduate on time and with less debt. So whatever opportunity you're looking for, make your impact sooner at UCM, with campuses located in Warrensburg, Lee's Summit, and online. Find out more about UCM and the power of opportunity in action at ucmo.edu.
This is Voices of UCM, sponsored by Rise Community Services. Today, we sat down with Professor of Economics, Christopher Azevedo. We talk about his approach to teaching economics, his research interests, and his collection of kazoos. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Voices of UCM. I'm your host, Andrew Zellner, and today I am sitting down with economics professor Christopher Azevedo. How are you doing today, Christopher?
I'm doing great.
That's good, yeah. End of the semester, going roughly pretty well?
Yeah, it's starting to wind down. I think we've got a couple of weeks of classes left and then finals week, so it's kind of crunch time now.
Yeah, that's kind of how it is for me, too. It's like everything's starting to come up all of a sudden. It's like, ooh, yep, there's everything there.
Busy time.
yep, for sure. So how did you initially like get into the economics field?
I went to Missouri State University, and I went to college as a math major and then eventually changed to history. And then I had to take a general ed class that was an economics class, and I just – something about that class just – really clicked with me, and I had a great professor named Dr. Lagos, and it was just really appealing, kind of the types of topics that you study in economics, and it just clicked with me, and I thought I think this is what I need to be doing. So
so it was just that pretty much that one class that just kind of
that
set
kicked it off. And I think it was a lot of that was Dr. Lagos.
Oh, yeah.
He was just a great professor. And, you know, I liked all the rest of the classes, but that one was just kind of magical in a way.
I think definitely like the teacher of like certain classes, there are just some teachers out there that can make any subject interesting.
Because, I agree.
And because of just how they teach.
Yeah. And I think you never really know how much of it's due to the teacher, but I think a lot of what people end up studying, the paths that they choose, a lot of that is driven by having a good teacher somewhere along
Definitely,
the way.
Definitely, yeah.
Or having a bad one that steers you away from something.
For sure.
So, yeah.
Because, like, there's all those stories, like, you hear from various people. It's like, oh, yeah, I had the worst biology teacher.
Exactly.
I had the worst math teacher. And, you know, it's going to set you off those things because it's like, well,
yeah,
That teacher didn't teach it right, or for whatever reason it might be, it's like, it's a deterrent.
Well, and I hear a lot of times people will ask me what I do, and I say economics, and they think, or they'll say, oh, I hated economics. And I know it's not because of economics. It's because they had somebody that taught it that just wasn't inspiring. Economics is an easy thing to make boring.
Yeah, because, and, I mean, it's a lot of vocabulary. It's a lot of math, obviously, because it's economics, but like, so it's very easy to dull it down to make it uninteresting.
Exactly.
So kind of going into that, how do you, like, I don't know if spice up is the right word, but like, make economics interesting, how about in your classes?
Well, I think most people are kind of under the impression that economics is mostly about business or mostly about the stock market, and and, you know, we talk about stuff like that, but
right.
Economics is really just the study of human behavior. And so what I've found works best is to focus on the parts of human behavior that people find interesting. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, if you just do business examples, it's easy to lose interest in that.
Right,
but,
yeah.
I use a lot of sports examples, a lot of in fact, I teach a whole class in sports economics, which is really just the application of economic principles to what people are doing in a sports situation. So I think it's a matter of convincing people that economics is the study of what you're doing every day. Every decision you make, economists study in some form or another.
Right, yeah. Because I remember back in high school, I had an economics class, and, it, you know, it was kind of boring because I feel like they didn't focus on it was basically only on, hey, this is the application in the business world. This
exactly.
isn't.
Yeah.
And I feel like I ended up getting lost at a lot of points. 'Cause I'm like, this doesn't have any, I can't relate this to anything in my,
right.
in my immediate vicinity.
Right. Yeah. I think one of the things that there's a podcast, well, it started out as a book, but the Freakonomics podcasts,
oh, yeah.
what those guys have done is do a really good job of picking out all of the really interesting applications of economics. And,
mm-hmm.
and I think if you, and I probably model my teaching after their approach.
Okay.
You know, I'd rather talk about why you choose to work an hour or study an hour or relax an hour rather than why you're going to produce this good or not.
Right, yeah.
The working and the choice of leisure and work, that's a much more interesting thing to most people.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, because it is more applicable to their everyday life. If you're talking only about goods and services, it's like, well, I right. might do that for a job, but that's not really going to be what I'm all
yeah.
about necessarily.
Exactly. Yeah, I mean, economics is about the stuff you do outside of business.
Yeah.
I think that's where it's most interesting.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, if you look at the research in economics, most research is done in areas outside of just business.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, business is interesting because there's dollars on the line. So
right.
I get that. But it's not interesting if you just want to sit around and have a conversation with somebody.
Well, yeah, because, I mean, like, if you're just going to be talking to, like, I don't know, someone at, like a Thanksgiving dinner or something like
right.
that about, like, oh, did you see the stock market's up? Nobody's really going to.
Right.
Unless they're also, like, big into the market or big into economics.
Sure.
They're probably not really going to be engaged with that conversation.
Right. Yeah, no, absolutely. Absolutely.
Mm-hmm. So that's cool. I'm glad we're able to find different ways to think about just various topics like economics. It's
yeah.
because like initially it's like, well, it's just money, but
right.
it seems like it's a lot more.
Oh,
and
yeah.
I think that's
no, it's way more than
that's
that.
That's interesting, yeah. Mm-hmm. So what are some of the other classes that you teach? You said you had that sports economics class.
Yeah, I teach principles of microeconomics and
mm-hmm.
principles of macroeconomics. I'll teach intermediate microeconomics,
mm-hmm.
which is just one level up from principles.
Uh-huh.
International economics.
Okay.
Of course, the sports economics.
Mm-hmm.
I teach environmental and natural resource economics.
Okay.
Seem like there might... I've taught mathematical economics
mm-hmm.
a time or two. I've even done a directed studies in the economics of the dental industry within
really?
The last couple of years. I've had a student that is now in the dental program up at the University of Iowa, and he
okay.
was wanting to take a kind of an individualized class on the application of economics to dentistry.
Hmm.
So that was interesting.
I'm sure that it was. That's definitely. Again, something you might not think about, like in economics, is the application of it in specifically dentistry,
exactly,
or the application on it in sports or something like that.
Well, the nice thing about it is, because economics is the study of just how people make decisions, you can apply it to anything,
yeah.
right? I mean, all of life is making decisions.
Mm-hmm.
We're making decisions right now about
yeah.
the questions you ask and the way I respond and.
Mm-hmm.
And I guarantee you there's some economist out there doing research on, you know, benefits and costs
mm-hmm.
as they relate to just personal interaction like
right,
this.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it can be applied to anything.
Mm-hmm. So for those like more like complex elements of economics, how do you go about teaching those things? Because obviously you have like the big micro and macro economics, but then there's like a bunch of other stuff inside that, and then there's stuff inside that. So how do you kind of, I don't know if condense is the right word, but make it digestible.
Yeah, I think for a lot of things, I think the hard work's been done in the past.
Okay.
So, you know, I'm not the first person to teach a sports economics class.
Mm-hmm.
So what I get to do is I get to benefit from, oh, the books, the textbooks that have
mm-hmm.
already been written, or, you know, I never took a sports economics class, but, you know, I can pretty easily get a textbook and read it, and
mm-hmm.
then that gives me a good kind of a good layout a skeleton, and then I get to pick kind of how I want to fill that in. A lot of times I'll a lot of times what I'll do at the beginning of a class like sports economics class is give the beginning of the semester like a list of things that might be interesting and let people kind of rank them. Like pick your top 15. And then just kind of tailor the class to what that particular group of students wants to talk about. And usually there's a lot of overlap. There's going to be some stuff, you know, everybody wants to talk about cheating in sports or gambling in sports or the use of performance-enhancing drugs or things like that. So I know within reason kind of what everybody's going to want to
do.
But then we could cover stuff that, you know, I don't need to already know it. I can go out and learn something real quick and then teach it to a class 2 weeks later. So, yeah, that's my approach is start with a kind of a textbook approach, the standard topics, and then kind of fill it in from there.
I like that idea of like that like the top 15 list. I think that's it's a good way to engage your students immediately because it's like, oh, I can kind of tailor what we're going to talk about. And that's not really the most standard way of teaching something because like usually it's like it's very like, oh, this is what we're talking about. This is where everything lines. But like being able to have that more dynamic aspect to it, I feel like not only makes it more engaging for students, but probably makes it more engaging for like professors who have to potentially go out and learn something new. So
And it you get I've found it helps students kind of buy into it at the beginning. They feel like they have input, which is important. And again, I know kind of there's some stuff we have to talk about.
Right,
so
obviously.
We have some flexibility. But, I mean, it keeps me on my toes because if enough of them want to do something that I haven't done yet, well, then, I get to go out and kind of learn that. As long as I've got a few weeks head start on them, I can do that.
I mean, like, it's not like you're going to be like one person suggests something. It's like, oh, I want to talk about this. And then you have it ready the next class period likely because
I might be able to pull that off, but I'd like to have a couple weeks.
I'd like to have a little bit of time to maybe properly educate myself on what exactly we're talking about. And are you also the program coordinator for the economics school?
Yeah.
Or not school, but department.
So, the Department of Economics and Finance. So we've got a finance coordinator, Jim Sison, and then I'm the economics coordinator. And yeah, basically that means that I meet with students when the department chair can't. I kind of advise a lot of students on you know, what classes to take and help with scheduling, things like that. So I think I've done that for... I think I've been the coordinator maybe the last 9 or 10 years.
Oh, yeah?
So, yeah.
So how's that, like generally, Ben, I guess, is like, you know, like it's more of an like advisor type of role?
Yeah, I mean, our department chair handles a lot of the bigger things, you know, and there's a lot of responsibility that goes with that. So I kind of get the easier job of, working closely with students, which I like. Helping with the schedule, but you know the Dr. Chambers, our department chair, does a real good job kind of handling the bigger things, and I get some of the easier stuff.
Okay,
so
that's fun then.
Yeah, it's a good job.
So is it like hard to is it hard sometimes to like balance that out between like professor work, and like program coordinator stuff?
Sometimes, but. So we went through a stretch where we didn't have a department chair. We just had a different kind of organizational structure. And back then it was harder to balance things because I had to do more administrative stuff. And my heart has not always been in administrative stuff. I'd rather work with students. So back then it was harder. Now we've got a department chair, which – she handles a lot of, well, she handles all of the administrative stuff. And again, I kind of get to cherry pick the easier stuff. So it's not a hard balance to maintain now.
Because, I would imagine without a chair, that's like, because I mean, like, there would be, you'd probably still have the two, like, advisors for.
Econ and finance.
For econ and finance. But, like, still, that's like a lot more work split up between the two of you, because you have that, you have to do the advisor role stuff, you have to do the scheduling, but you also have to do the administration.
Exactly.
So that's just like, that'd be a lot. And I think having it between the three people is probably, sounds like it would be a lot more manageable.
It's better, because what I think they realized was that when you have two people, both of us ended up doing a lot of the same administrative stuff.
Right, yeah.
Because we were focusing on different parts of the program. And so there's a benefit to having one person over both of them and handling the one person doing that administrative stuff. So I think this is – the way we've got it now is a better – it was a learning process. I understand why they did that back then, but I think this is better. I'm happier.
We'll be right back with more Voices of UCM. Brought to you by Rise Community Services.
That's the sound of a door slamming in your face. That's the sound heard by many individuals living with a disability. But it doesn't have to be. RISE Community Services is committed to opening doors, not closing them. We believe that each person deserves a life that is full of hope and empowered by self-choice. If you or a loved one need help, please visit watchusrise.org.
A degree in digital media production with an emphasis in audio will enhance your skill set for work in radio, television, film, and beyond. Our faculty members bring real-world experience to the classroom, and students can showcase their work on UCM Radio The Beat, as well as in film projects and live events. For more information on this or other concentrations within the Digital Media Production Program, please visit ucmo.edu/DMP.
Welcome back to Voices of UCM, brought to you by RISE Community Services. Today, we sat down with Professor of Economics, Christopher Azevedo. We continued our discussion by talking about the Forbes Room, and we also discussed his research interests. So, this is just like a personal question about, specifically, there's the room in Ward Edwards where it's like the, you have like the stock displays.
Yeah,
almost.
The Forbes Room.
The Forbes Room, is that what that is?
Mm-hmm.
I kind of want to know what that is.
So,
exactly.
Basically, what that is some terminals in there that where you can instantly access just about as much financial data as you could ever possibly need.
Okay.
They're called Bloomberg terminals, and so Dr. Sison does a student managed investment. What do they call it? The SMIF. Student Managed Investment Fund.
Okay.
And what that is a finance class where they manage a big chunk of money.
Oh, okay.
And it's not fake money. It's not like
real world stuff.
I think
stuff,
they started with maybe $500,000 and
that's a lot.
Yeah, they've been able to grow it to, I'm pretty sure, a little more than $1 million now over the last several years. So that's what that room is. They use it. It's mainly used by finance, but we have a lot of economics students that are either double majoring in economics and finance or economics students that have a minor in finance. So we have students from both majors that go in there and basically learn how to take, you can imagine there is a ton of information out there.
Oh, right, yeah, for sure.
And knowing what information's important and what's not is I think that's the room where you learn that.
Right, yeah, because, I mean, like, interpreting all the data that comes in with economics or finance is just, like, there's so much data. You need to know how to interpret it, how to read it, how to figure out which one's important, which one's not. That's,
exactly.
like, a super important skill.
Exactly.
And I think that's really cool that students here can get that opportunity in like in a more safe environment, whether as opposed to like them being like all out on their own in the real world. It's like, well, I have kind of an idea of what I'm doing, but not really any clues. So,
well, yeah, that's one of the nice things about the class is that if you're in that class and you've got an idea of maybe an investment that you think is a good idea, you've got to pitch it. And if you don't do a good job or you've overlooked something, it doesn't
go through. Yeah.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. And so I think it is a safer environment. Mm-hmm. I mean, they're still dealing with real money.
Right. Yeah.
So in that situation, it's very real, but it is safer to to run it by Dr. Sison, to have to pitch it to the other students. Mm-hmm. I hear a lot of good things about that class. Yeah. And I always encourage any student that's interested in saving money for the future and figuring out how mm-hmm. to take a small pile of money and make it into a bigger pile of money, look into that class. Mm-hmm. So,
yeah. I just remember always like walking past that room when I go to work. I'm like, I wonder what exactly that's for. And that's really cool that like I said, that we can give that opportunity to the students, because I think it's really cool that you can pitch stuff and then have it rejected or have it approved. I think that's great, because that's going to be real world applicable. It's going to be applicable in the real world, because that's how economics and finances work in the world.
And there's accountability, because
if you,
I mean, here's the thing: you could make a great decision, and it still doesn't turn out great,
right? Yeah, because of the market or whatever. A million different factors of something terrible could happen, and
there's randomness. Yeah. There's just the world is uncertain.
Yeah,
but it's immediately relevant because there's mm-hmm. actual money,
right?
I mean, it, you can go out and play a stock market game, and it mm-hmm. might be interesting, and you might learn from it.
Right.
But you're not going to learn as much as if you've actually got real
some
dollars.
Money. Yeah,
you've won or lost real mm-hmm. dollars. That's that's different.
That impact there, I imagine, is huge for students.
Exactly. I hear really good things about
mm-hmm.
it. Yeah.
So, yeah, kind of jumping off that, what are some other like opportunities and experiences, I guess, that the program offers its students?
Well, there's several professors that do research with students. So over the last several years, I've done research with a number of students.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's something that's unique that you don't find uh-huh. in a lot of other institutions. If you go to a bigger school, like, say, a Mizzou,
mm-hmm.
As a student, you're probably not going to have the opportunity to do real research mm-hmm. with a professor. Those professors have to get, they've got to get publications.
Mm-hmm.
They're under a different set of
requirements.
Here, we've got the freedom to be able to do that, so that's nice.
Mm-hmm.
Interacting with students, I think, is probably my favorite part of this whole job.
Uh-huh.
I liked college.
Mm-hmm.
And this has given me the opportunity to kind of stay in college for the rest of my life, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So I really like working with students on classes, research, anything mm-hmm. like that.
That's cool. That's cool that students and professors can work together on research or a project. I think that's just really cool, because I've said this like several times as I talk to various people from various professors and stuff, but like having that student-professor relationship is huge for just understanding each other, understanding the class, having a better understanding of the relationship in class and stuff. It's huge.
Right. Yeah. No, I think sometimes I can remember as a student being intimidated by a lot of professors.
There's definitely that intimidation there, especially like when you're first starting out. It's like, I don't want to step out of line or anything.
Exactly, and you know, I get that, but I think I prefer. I mean, I was just a student. It doesn't feel like that long ago, and you know, I was the same as every student we've got here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I wasn't born any genius by any means. So I feel kinship with students,
mm-hmm.
and so my goal is to try to convince students that I'm not any different than they are.
Right.
I studied a lot at one mm-hmm. point in my life, and there have been times when I've worked real hard at academia, but
mm-hmm.
in the end, I'm just another kid from South Missouri that, you know. So I like working with students because it wasn't that long ago. I was just one of them.
Mm-hmm.
So,
well, yeah, I think the big difference between like a high school or a college, and kind of going back off to like that intimidation initially, is that like in high school, it's like, at least in my experience, I don't know how it's panning out for this newer generation, but like mm-hmm. it always felt like you just go to class, you don't really talk, and then it was slightly changing as I was like getting through. I was like, okay, yeah, there's a bit more interaction between professor and then, or I guess teacher and student. Mm-hmm. But like in college, I think the big difference is that since everyone here is an adult for the pretty much for the most part, that's it almost like levels the playing field almost.
Right.
But I feel like initially, like when you're like when you're 18 just out, it doesn't feel that way.
Right.
But like as I've continued on, I'm like, okay, yeah, we're all just kind of adults here. We can all have conversations like we're just adults. There's no real. There doesn't need to be like the huge gap between the student and the professor.
Yeah, and I think one of the unfortunate things about high school is there's a lot of noise there.
There's
a lot of stuff happening that, you know, for whatever reason.
Yeah, there's just it's a big part of people's growing period.
Right.
Because, like, everything is changing either internally or externally. So it's just a lot of changes happening at once, and then it's just, like, everyone mixing together in that setting. It's just it doesn't work out sometimes.
And there's a lot of there's a lot more people at that level that don't want to be there, you know, and and that's
a huge difference between
that
and college, because college is like most for the most part, people are wanting to be here, engage in what they're paying for.
Exactly. And so I like that because I don't think I would have made it very long as a high school teacher. My parents were both. My dad was a high school teacher. My mom taught kindergarten most of her career, and so I appreciate that. It's a hard job, and it takes a different amount. It takes a different set of skills
it
than
does.
What I need.
Yeah,
and so I think for me, I've been very happy doing what I am doing because it's I just feel like there's more people in the room with me that that want to be there and that are genuinely interested.
Yeah.
So makes it more rewarding, I think.
Right, yeah. So kind of going off of the research stuff, what kind of research have you conducted with students? What's some various research projects you've done?
I've got a project. So I've done a lot of research on grit.
On grit.
What makes people gritty.
Mm.
So you look at successful people, and there are a lot of successful people who are really smart.
Mm-hmm.
There are a lot of successful people who just worked really hard. And
right.
So I think the biggest thing that separates people who are successful from people who are not successful is the ability to just kind of buckle down and be gritty, stick-to-itiveness.
Okay.
And so I've done a lot of research on that, on on trying to figure out ways to estimate a student's grit.
Okay.
And so I've done some research with a student here, a UCM student, one of our economics students named Lauren Baker, and that was Lauren was a McNair student, and did a really great job on a project. Ended up getting the top paper in the McNair program this past year. And so that's been a really satisfying kind of research project to work on. I've also done research in environmental and natural resource economics, and specifically in estimating the value that people place on things like water quality, air quality. So I've done that. I've done a fair amount of sports research. We've a colleague of mine that used to be an economics professor here at UCM, Skip Crooker. He's now the provost for decision science at UNLV. But he and I have done several different sports, mainly baseball research projects. We got a paper published not too long ago on the changes in Major League Baseball that happened in the early 1970s that kind of changed the way teams were managed.
Okay,
So, yeah, I've done a wide variety of different projects.
Uh-huh.
I've even worked on another economics professor here at UCM, Dr. Johnson, and I have worked on a project on changes in the housing market during COVID and how that was different in Republican versus Democrat-dominated counties in the United States.
Uh-huh.
So we're hoping to get that published here fairly quickly. But I've got widely varying interests in research.
I can definitely tell. That's a good variety of stuff.
Yeah.
It's like kind of all completely separate, but also all still falling under that realm of that wide realm of economics that we were talking about. It's like
decisions.
Yeah, decisions. Right. And I think it's really interesting looking at like specifically like that concept of grit.
Yeah.
I think how do you really even measure that in someone? I guess that's what your research is about.
Yeah. So there's a kind of the first researcher that really looked into grit was a psychologist named Angela Duckworth. And what she did was she looked at having people answer 12 questions and basically just give themselves a ranking.
Yeah.
And so the questions would be stuff like, I always finish something once I start it.
Okay.
So on a scale of 1 to 5, is that not like you or very much like you? Or I often get distracted by new projects.
Uh-huh.
So you answer these 12 questions. You use those numbers from the question answers to come up with a score. It's basically an average.
Okay.
And then there have been a lot of researchers that have looked to see whether that number that you get from that answering those 12 questions can be used to predict success.
Okay.
And it turns out it can.
Mm.
Well, so what Dr. Kirker and I were interested in years ago was whether or not, so there's a problem with people answering questions. Survey data is notoriously unreliable.
Right, yeah.
So what we thought was, well, let's see if we can come up with a way of taking not people's answers to questions, but their actual performance in college.
Right.
And let's see if we can use that data to estimate a number for them that will tell us their grit. So what we did was we've got data on every grade that a group of students got in every class. We've got information, sociodemographic information. We've got information on who taught the class, the topic of the class. Essentially, a ton of information about students' college experience.
Right.
We've got a model that we put together that uses all of that data to generate a number for each student.
Mm-hmm.
And that number is, we call it their grit score.
Uh-huh.
And it turns out that you can use that number to predict success.
Okay.
And so it's an alternative to what Angela Duckworth came up with.
Mm-hmm.
But essentially both of them are ways of estimating the stick-to-itiveness of a person, an individual person. So, there's a lot of I think there's a lot of uses for that, right?
Right.
I think the biggest one is, can you change it, right?
Yeah.
I mean, is a person's grit, or are you just stuck with that, or could you become grittier?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of angles we haven't looked at yet, but it's pretty interesting.
Yeah, that definitely is interesting, looking at specifically, I mean, like having all that data, I imagine it would be super useful for that sort of thing, right?
Yeah, and I think, you know, you couldn't have done this 20 years ago.
Well,
I think computing ability has advanced to a point where you can use data sets with millions of observations in them now and easily handle that. And
you can throw it into a spreadsheet as long as you put in the right calculations and stuff, it'll just kind of do everything for you.
Exactly. Yeah, it's amazing what we can do that we couldn't have done 5-10 years ago.
Well, yeah, even thinking about like just the collection of the data, like when everything was on paper, like imagine having to sift through all of that even get like a small sample size of that sort of data.
When I was in grad school, you know, that wasn't actually that long ago, but that was still back in the days when I was going to the library, finding articles or finding sources of data and actually, you know, sitting there and entering data manually.
Yeah.
And nowadays, we can code bots to go out and get that data
for us.
So you can, in an hour, you could get more data than you could have gotten in a whole year.
Yeah.
You know, 30 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
So it's incredible.
It's really a marvel just in general how much technology has advanced, even in like the past like 20, 25 years.
Exactly.
It's like, it's huge.
Exactly.
And you get all those small impact like on research projects like this that require a ton of data. It's just so much easier to get that information now.
It's easier also to take an idea and apply it to different things.
Yeah.
You'd have a data set, and you could do some stuff with it, but it was harder to to apply your model to a different data set. And now we can do that nearly instantaneously.
Right, yeah.
Data is very available. The challenge now is being able to sift through good data and bad data.
Yeah, because there is so much of it. Like, even like when you're going on like a very small scale, you still have to sift through
exactly
a ton of data that probably isn't worthwhile to you at this at that point in time.
And you don't always know it when it's not.
Yeah.
You know, that's the challenge.
It's tricky.
Being able to figure out when it's good data, when it's not.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. Stay tuned for more after this break. Voices of UCM is sponsored by Rise Community Services.
Every minute, there are 6 children born in the U.S., and one of them will be born with a developmental disability. Rise Community Services believes that an individual's potential doesn't vanish simply because they were born with a unique set of challenges. We believe that each person deserves a life full of hope and empowered by self-choice. If you or a loved one need help, please visit watchusrise.org.
A degree in digital media production with an emphasis in sports communication will enhance your knowledge in multi-camera live sports productions, in addition to writing for sports media. Our faculty members bring real-world experience to the classroom, and students can showcase their work through different media outlets, including live streaming under the MIAA Network, UCMCTV, and digitalberg.com. For more information on this, please visit ucmo.edu/DMP.
You're listening to Voices of UCM, sponsored by Rise Community Services. Today, we sat down with Professor of Economics, Christopher Azevedo. We finish our discussion by talking about his musical talents and his collection of kazoos. Well, I think we're going to go ahead and move on from economic stuff. I was talking to Joe beforehand. He was telling me about a lot of the music stuff that you do. So let's go ahead. Let's go ahead and talk about some of that then.
Absolutely. Yeah.
So, let's start out with what instruments do you play?
Oh gosh, I started out many years ago learning guitar.
Yeah.
My grandma was a guitar player. My dad was a guitar player, and so I just grew up kind of with guitars around, and have always played that. I play a decent amount, enough banjo to be able to claim that I play a banjo.
Mm-hmm.
Mandolin, harmonica. Yeah. And enough of some other instruments to kind of trick somebody into thinking I know how to play them. Once you become a semi-proficient musician, it turns out you can pick up an instrument you may never have played before and make pleasant noises with it. So, but I'd say probably guitar, banjo, and maybe mandolin are the main things that I would claim to be able to play.
Uh-huh. Because at least for like the string, like a lot of the string instruments, they're pretty,
yeah,
relatively similar across the board.
Yeah, tunings are different.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean once you understand how to play strings, it transfers to other instruments well.
Mm-hmm. He was also Joe was also talking about like a lot of stuff about kazoos as well.
Oh, many years ago I was looking for something to collect that would be plentiful and not expensive, because over the years I've collected a variety of things that I'm a collector of things.
Yeah.
So, yeah, I started collecting kazoos maybe 20 years ago, 25 years ago, and now I had no idea at the beginning how old the kazoo was. It was invented in the 1880s.
Oh, yeah.
And so there are many, many variations of kazoos over the years, and I have nearly all of them.
Wow, yeah.
I'm at a point now where there aren't any surprises anymore, and I have thousands of kazoos.
Mm-hmm.
And it turns out that if you collect those really old ones, they're not cheap. So
I'm sure.
What I thought was going to be a really cheap hobby turned out to I mean, it's still in the whole scope of things.
In the scope of collecting, at least.
It's
not like you're collecting luxury cars or anything.
Exactly. Yeah, exactly. But in terms of kazoos, there's some expensive ones.
So. Well, yeah. I mean, like, there's going to be expensive things in any collectible hobby, so.
Exactly.
Now, granted, I imagine kazoos are a lot, like you said, they're a lot going to be a lot cheaper generally because,
right.
I mean, like, they're generally seen as, like, a very cheap instrument, so.
Yeah, and, the thing that I've liked about it we don't realize it because all of us have been alive after the kazoo was invented. It's no big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But when the kazoo was invented, that was a really big deal.
Right, yeah, because...
I mean, it was an instrument that anybody could play. Mm-hmm. You don't have to have any musical skill. If you can hum a song, you can play a kazoo.
Yeah.
And there were kazoo bands that were formed.
Mm-hmm.
And these bands would have maybe 50 people, and they would travel to mm-hmm. cities or to other countries and put on concerts. And
mm-hmm.
And kazoos were built into instruments that were made to look like other brass instruments.
Yeah.
And it was a big deal.
Yeah.
And you know, none of us, unless you look into it, mm-hmm. would ever even realize that.
Yeah,
and
because...
So it's fascinating.
Camille, yeah, right at the start, obviously, you don't have, like, an instrument that you can just pick up and play. You kind of just have to... You kind of have to learn how to use it, but the kazoo is just like, you hold it up and then you start humming, basically, and then, yeah,
well,
there you go.
The thing that amazes me is, so I've been in different bands where we have had kazoos made with maybe our band logo on them, and and so I've given out a lot of kazoos, and I'm
mm-hmm.
shocked at the number of people who don't even realize now how to even play a kazoo. They feel like they have to blow through it,
that's
and I'm always
works.
Like, look, no, you just hum a song.
Yeah, you just hum.
It's the great equalizer of instruments, right?
That's
it's
a
very democratic
that.
Instrument in the mm-hmm. sense that we can all participate.
Yeah.
It can be fun. It can be really annoying if we're not careful. But,
mm-hmm.
yeah, no, I love kazoos.
Yeah. If you know what you're doing with it, you can actually do some pretty cool stuff with it.
It actually can be a musical instrument
mm-hmm.
if it's done correctly and in the right amount.
Let's yeah. I think collecting in general is a very interesting, again, human behavior because, I mean, like, I feel like all of us are collectors in some sense, collecting various different things. Like, I collect a ton of different stuff. I'm big into, like, a lot of physical media right now. I've been trying to get my hands on a lot of various DVDs, Blu-rays, CDs, cassettes, stuff like that.
Yep.
But it's always been interesting just seeing, like, the culture around collecting in particular. It's interesting to see how that develops.
Well, and, you know, I think for people who are collectors, I think it's like an adventure.
Yeah.
Right? And it's the thing that is the best is finding something you've been looking for.
Yeah.
That feeling of stumbling across something.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, that for me, I feel like I need to find something new because
there's
just not – I've seen every kazoo out there.
Yeah, when you're at the end of the collecting, the collecting game, essentially, there.
Right. Occasionally, I'll stumble across something, but not like I did 20 years ago. And
right.
So,
yeah.
Yeah. I'm gonna need to come up with some new new thing to focus on,
mm-hmm.
maybe.
Yeah, maybe because I mean, like, once you get to that end of the collect, where I kind of have everything I want, you lose out on that feeling of again finding something at like a thrift store or at a yard sale or something like that.
Yep.
It's like, oh. The thing I want, it's just,
exactly.
it's really an unmatched feeling.
Oh, yeah. I found a guitar one time here in town at downtown. Those were the days.
Oh, yeah.
This was 15 years ago.
Mm.
It was a guitar made in the late 1800s. It was bad shape.
Uh-huh.
It was made by the Jupiter Guitar Company.
Mm.
I think they wanted $25 for it, and I took it down to buy it, and this lady at the front desk just... It was like she felt so sorry for me. She's like, oh, honey, you don't want this guitar. Why don't you get one that you can actually play? And I said, no, I do want it. She's like, yeah, but it's just in bad shape. Anyway, I bought it.
Mm-hmm.
I had it fixed up.
Yeah.
It's one of my prize collection items because I found it in the most unexpected
mm-hmm.
place, and it turned out to be such a great sounding guitar. It plays well.
Yeah,
those... That feeling of
mm-hmm.
that find when you first see it, and you're like, oh my goodness, that's great.
Yeah, because it's almost like you said, it's like an adventure. It's like
you're
discovering stuff.
Exactly. Mm-hmm. It's like all of the good frontiers have kind of been explored, I guess, except maybe deep sea.
And
but, you
maybe
know,
and maybe space.
Yeah,
but
space.
But even still, those two things are not going to be within probably either of our lifetimes.
Right, exactly. But for us, that's like the frontier.
Yeah.
It's finding some
mm-hmm.
new thing that you're interested
in. Because, I mean, like, especially with, like, older pieces like that, it's almost like you're uncovering history.
Well, and saving it. For me, I mentioned I was a history major.
Mm-hmm.
I've always been a history buff, and I like the idea of appreciating what things were like 100 years ago, 150 years ago, and the idea that the instruments that they were playing back then are pretty much the same as the instruments that we're playing now, that fascinates me, and so, it's great.
Yeah, and then, like, being able to, like, restore these pieces as well. Like you said, you restored it, and now it plays great. Like, if you hadn't gotten it, then it very well may have just sat there and then someone threw it out, and then nobody gets to experience that anymore.
Exactly. And that, you know, for me, that's always a challenge. Like, how much do you restore it, right?
Yeah, I mean, because you have to figure out, it's like, well, I want to keep it authentic, but I want to be able to still play it.
Right, yeah. So my approach has always been for some, and I don't do the work. I'm not a luthier, so my skills with guitars.
That's a whole different skill set, yeah.
So, but what I always tell anybody, if I've got a guitar, and I've done it a few times over the years, is just make it structurally work.
Yeah.
Don't pretty it up. Mm-hmm. I think the nicks, you know, fix anything structurally, like cracks that need to be fixed.
Yeah.
But don't fix the finish, right? I mean, if that, that's part of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so, yeah, I like to keep them looking the way that I found them.
Mm-hmm.
But I want them to be able to be structurally sound.
So, right, yeah.
Not everybody would agree with that.
But yeah, but
that's my approach.
Yeah, So I think we're gonna finish off with, like you were talking about, like you were in several bands. What kind of bands were you in?
Well, so I was in a band here with some other economics or some other professors here on campus called Banjo Camp Massacre.
That was fun.
Several years ago. Yeah, that was kind of a, I don't even know how to describe that one. My current band is a band called Knobtown Skiffle Band. And it's me playing a resonator guitar. I've got a guy named Isaac Neal that plays washboard for me, and a lady named Jennifer Miller that plays bass. And we play, it's hard to describe. It's, you can't summarize it in one word. It's kind of like a little bit of jazz, a little bit of blues. Kind of like string band music from the 1920s.
Okay.
So it's hard to categorize.
Okay, yeah.
But it's fun. People seem to like it. We have a good time doing it. So
that's all. Then yeah, that's all that really matters.
That's right.
That's all. It's always so interesting discovering like those smaller bands where it's like, I'm not really sure what the genre is, but I'm kind of vibing with it.
Well, you know, we called it Knobtown Skiffle Band. There was actually a skiffle craze in the 50s and 60s.
Okay.
And skiffle is kind of the word used to describe a band that uses improvised instruments.
Okay.
So like a washtub bass or a washboard.
Right.
But we don't play 1950s or 60s skiffle.
Right.
But here's the nice thing. Most people don't have any idea what skiffle is.
Mm.
And so when they hear it, it doesn't have any preconceived notions. There's no baggage that goes with it. So we can do anything we want.
Mm.
And, you know, if we were a blues band and we played something that wasn't blues, people would say, hold it. You
can't
do
blues.
That.
You can't do that.
Nobody knows what skiffle is.
I imagine that's very freeing as a musician because you can just kind of
do whatever you want.
Yeah.
Yep. It is. Now, I'd like to be able to claim that was all part of my plan. we came up with a name and it
just kind of worked out that way.
Exactly.
That's always the funny way things happen like that. Yeah.
That's right.
All right. Well, I think that's a great place to end off the show. I appreciate you coming on.
Well, thanks for having me.
This has been Voices of UCM, sponsored by RISE Community Services. Be sure to tune in next week at 7 p.m. on both Wednesday and Saturday. You can listen to the show at ucmbeat.com on either the live feed or at any time by going to the Shows tab and finding the Voices of UCM tab. Once again, I'm your host, Andrew Zellner, and we'll talk next time on Voices of UCM.